From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Today, George W. Bush met with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. There were some divisive issues on the table, like freedom and nuclear proliferation. But at the end of the session, when Bush and Putin faced the press, the U.S. president said they emerged with a good working relationship.
Even though we didn't agree on certain issues, if you really think about what we have done during the last 4 years and what we want to do during the next 4 years, the common ground is a lot more than those areas where we disagree.
Still, the areas of disagreement include some major sticking points that a few hours of face-to-face discussion aren't likely to solve. Tonight on Point, the U.S. and Russia finding the way forward. We begin in Bratislava, Slovakia, where Bush and Putin met earlier today. It was President Bush's final stop on his five-day diplomatic tour through Europe. Mark Silva is the White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He spoke with me from Bratislava, and I asked him if President Bush was warmly welcomed by the Slovakians.
Oh yes, he was greeted in the town square of Bratislava. Bush stood in front of the National Theater and reminded people that this was one of the places where public protests had led in the old Czechoslovakia to a so-called Velvet Revolution, which liberated the country, and then the nations divided and became two peacefully. And people cheered him. There were several thousand people there. It was a campaign-styled rally, really. People were given these little paper Slovak flags to wave, and Secretary of State Condi Rice stood in the stands waving her Slovak flag and smiling at the crowd. So it was a pretty strong event.
There were a number of agreements that came out of the meeting between Bush and Putin. Can you perhaps give us the top two or three?
Sure. This was a separate affair. After meeting with the Prime Minister of Slovakia, Bush had what has been described to us tonight as a record meeting with Putin, although this is the 13th time that they've met face-to-face. They met apparently for 2.5 hours today, and that included over an hour, just one-to-one with interpreters only, and then more than an hour with aides. And they issued a couple of statements tonight. They issued a statement committing the United States and Russia to working more toward keeping nuclear materials from the hands of terrorists, to increase the safety and security of nuclear facilities. And they also agreed to work harder on keeping shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles out of the hands of terrorists by destroying or decommissioning these devices that are known as MANPADs, which is a strange term, but it's an acronym. They also agreed that they'll work together to see that Russia is able to join the World Trade Organization by the end of this year, or at least attempt to secure that. And they agreed that Iran should not be allowed to develop nuclear weapons, and reiterated their commitment that North Korea should disarm. And they made some trade agreements as well, but these were the chief agreements.
Mark, as you certainly know, earlier this week, Russia came in for a public scolding from President Bush. Did the two appear to be on pretty friendly terms again, or did things appear to be a bit cool between them?
Well, this is the area where they're having a little trouble. And you know, Bush came out of this meeting sort of acting like Bush, very friendly and jocular and having a good time. And Putin, was, on the other hand, was quite stern and really even testy on the subject of democracy in particular. Putin was extremely testy in defending his nation's institutions and suggested that he even termed criticism of press freedom there as a problem that's being, quote, addressed for nothing, and said, I do not think this has to be pushed to the foreground. I don't think we should jeopardize Russian-American relations with this. And he also made a very interesting comment about his regional parliaments are selecting presidents. The members of those parliaments are elected, but the presidents are not. And, you know, he said this situation was similar to the Electoral College in the United States, which you'll recall seated Bush as president in 2000 without the benefit of the popular vote. So, you know, Putin very wryly sort of suggested that the United States doesn't have the most, you know, completely pure democracy either. And I think this is an area that Putin would just as soon not talk about. That, you know, there's plenty of things they should be talking about, but Putin considers this an irritation, really.
Well, and an irritation along the lines, I think the comparison he used was, if you have a log in your eye, don't start looking at the splinter in ours.
Well, that's right. And, you know, he did make an interesting statement. He said, listen, you know, Russia has made its choice in favor of democracy. He said 14 years ago, independently, without any pressure from the outside, it made that decision in the interest of itself. And this is our final choice, and we have no way back. There can be no return to what we used to have before. Any return to totalitarianism would be impossible. Those were his words. So Bush took that as an interesting comment, you know, and an important statement. And Putin says, look, you know, Putin is basically saying, have some patience with us. We have our own issues. The security of our country is important. We can't descend into chaos, he suggested. And this is, I think, a veiled reference to the suppression of radical forces in Russia and also the Chechen rebel situation. Yeah, the administration later tonight was saying that Russia's coming out of a very difficult era, so these things aren't all going to change all at once.
Was there any mention of congressional attempts to perhaps boot Russia out of the G8, or did that not come up?
Well, not that we know about. There was, like I say, a good half of this meeting was completely private, Bush and Putin and their translators, and I don't think anything leaves the room except what the presidents tell us about, and they certainly didn't tell us about that.
And what happens now? You're almost ready to come home?
Yeah, this is the end of a four-day spree of meetings that started in Brussels, Belgium on Monday and carried us to Germany yesterday and into Bratislava last night, where this wonderful band of gypsies, for lack of a better term, was playing violins and a tremendous Slovak instrument called the cymbal, which kind of looked like a hammer harpsichord. And this has been a great little tour, and the president seems to have enjoyed much of it. You know, he's been exuding this confidence that we've really seen, you know, at home as well since the election. And, you know, I think the re-election sort of bolstered his confidence in his own abilities to win and persuade people. And he came here with sort of that same swagger. And pretty much throughout the week, except for times when he's showed some obvious exhaustion, he's been a pretty happy-looking Bush.
So the White House feels that this is a trip that went well.
Yeah, I think they feel that they've achieved things they wanted to achieve. They got the Chancellor of Germany and the President of France to agree that the Iraq question, which was so contentious, you know, both countries had opposed the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Bush got them to say publicly that, look, that's behind us. You know, we're moving on. There's lots of other things that we care about in a common interest. And they wanted that very much to be stated. And Bush recognized the European Union as the dominant force in Europe. And then this meeting with Putin, the president wanted to hold him to some issues. And I don't think anybody expected Vladimir Putin to walk out of the meeting and say, okay, you know, I give up. The press is free, and I'm not going to consolidate, you know, power in my government. These things don't occur overnight.
Mark Silva, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mark Silva is White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He spoke to us from Bratislava, Slovakia. We're talking this hour about the way forward for U.S.-Russia relations. Should the U.S. take a hard line to try and limit Putin's authoritarian rule? Do you see Russia as a good diplomatic partner for the U.S.? Or has it slid too far from democracy? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Marshall Goldman, Professor Emeritus of Russian Economics at Wellesley College, also Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. He has followed Russia for years, written many books about it, most recently The Piratization of the Russian Economy. Welcome, Marshall.
Thanks, Gail.
So you've been watching these two former foes, now friends, for decades. How would you describe the relationship now between the U.S. and Russia?
The relationship between the U.S. and Russia has actually deteriorated in the last couple months, partly because each country is now beginning to follow its own agenda, and there are constituencies in both countries which suggest that there is suspicion and skepticism about what the other country is doing. What is remarkable and what we just heard is, despite that, the two leaders, in a way that I don't ever remember American-Soviet-American-Russia relations existing like this, where the two leaders have bonded in a way that's almost like summer camp or a basketball team or something like this, and they're prepared to deal with one another and try to push through these differences and override them. where they think it's important for the two countries to stay together in ways and overlook things despite the fact that their subordinates or the people associated with them are very critical. So it's just a remarkable kind of thing to see.
Well, and clearly it is more diplomatic and perhaps more effective to praise in public and then scold in private. So were you surprised when President Bush went public with his criticism earlier this week?
I was a little bit surprised. You know, there had been Condoleezza Rice, and our new Secretary of State, had issued a statement which was critical of the Russians before, saying much the same as what President Bush later said. But, of course, he said it. And he said it at a time when it was clear that the journalists who were with him had been led to believe he would not address what was going on in Russia and would not be so negative. So that he said these things, which indeed I think have bothered a lot of us and said them openly, was clearly going to cause some tension because President Putin is a very strong leader, doesn't like criticism, and he's also no dummy. And some of the things the man from the Chicago Tribune just said suggests that, you know, Putin has a response. He does see that we're not perfect in this country, and he's perfectly prepared to lecture to us just as President Bush is prepared to lecture to him.
In just a few seconds we have before we need to take a break, does Russia still present a special challenge to the U.S. even though there's no more Soviet Union, no longer a superpower?
It certainly does. It's not for ideological reasons anymore. The Cold War is over, but we have balance of power interests. Russia's a big country. It has energy. We're a big country. We need energy. They're interested in affecting relations around them. We're interested in affecting their neighbors, affecting what their neighbors are doing, and the Russians are nervous about that and resent our interference in what they see in their backyard.
Hold the thought. We're going to continue in just a moment. We're talking this hour about relations between Russia and the U.S. the day after a big meeting between the two countries' presidents. With all of Bush's rhetoric about democracy in other parts of the world, can the president afford not to take a stand in Russia? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. In the lead up to today's meeting of U.S. President George Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin, there was considerable debate about how the two might come to terms on the increasing authoritarianism in the former Soviet state. Today, through his interpreter, Putin reiterated his support for democracy.
Russia has made its choice in favor of democracy 14 years ago. Independently, without any pressure from outside, it made that decision in the interests of itself, in the interests of its people.
And President Bush said Putin's word was good enough for him.
The most important statement that you heard, and I heard, was the president's statement when he declared his absolute support for democracy in Russia, and they're not turning back.
Do you agree with Putin's statement that Russia has chosen democracy? And what about President Bush's response? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Marshall Goldman's in the studio with me now. He's a professor emeritus of Russian economics at Wellesley College, associate director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. And joining me from Washington is David Satter, visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Foreign Policy Institute, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He's the author of Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State, and for many years was a correspondent for the Financial Times from the former Soviet Union. David, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm glad to join you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. I'm interested in what you make of the significance of President Bush going into this meeting having publicly criticized Putin. We know Putin doesn't take that well to criticism. Do you think he is, in fact, backsliding from democracy, or is he just doing it the Russian way?
Well, he's backsliding from even that limited degree of democracy which existed in Russia. The idea that Russia made a democratic choice is not 100% true. Russia has never been a true democracy. It's never had honest presidential elections. And most important, it has never had the rule of law. And without the rule of law, you really can't have a democracy. So Putin's statement was not fully accurate, to put it mildly, and Bush's acceptance of that statement at face value indicates the degree to which he really doesn't want to deal with this question of what is going on inside Russia at the moment, even though that has implications for the kind of country that we're going to be dealing with and the world situation as a whole.
So Bush perhaps felt that he said what he had to say, and so now it was time to put a good face on the matter?
Hard to say. If we're talking about public statements, he didn't say much. A lot has been made over his remarks in Brussels, but all he really said was that a democratic country requires a viable opposition, a free press, a meaningful parliament. These are truisms that only gave offense and only were interpreted as being a rebuke to Putin because there's a general subconscious awareness that those things are not being respected in Russia today. He was not very specific in his remarks, and whatever he may have said in private in Bratislava, what he said publicly was absolutely anodyne. And I think gave a misleading impression that the United States and even this administration is fully satisfied with what's happening in Russia, or at least is not dissatisfied and believes that the country is on the path of democratic development. This is just not true.
Well, on which of these issues should the United States hold firm, and why?
I think there are several issues that are very, very important. These are also issues in which the United States can be effective in dealing with Russia. The first and most important is the rule of law. And in practical terms, that means objecting to selective prosecution. What has happened in Russia during the last decade or so is that massive corruption and lawlessness has created a situation in which virtually anyone can be hauled in by the prosecutor and charged with a crime. In some cases, the crimes that they're being charged for are crimes which were not really on the books at the time they were committed, although the acts were clearly unethical and immoral. But in any case, what happens is that virtually the entire business and political class feels intimidated and is aware that at any moment they can be charged with some misdeed, which was typical of the behavior of everyone else at the time that it was committed. This is the new form of political persecution, because, in fact, it's only those who in some way or the other offend the Putin regime politically who are called to account, and the Khodorkovsky case is the perfect example. Khodorkovsky is not guilty of anything that was not done by many of Putin's favorites, his favorite businessmen, his favorite oligarchs. But Khodorkovsky worked for political pluralism. Once he had made his money, he turned around and created a transparent, honest, and well-run Western company, or Russian company that was as well-run as a company in the West. And he began to use his profits to encourage the development of civil society. And this is what got him in trouble, and that's why he's in jail. And that's why human rights defenders in Russia insist that he's a political prisoner.
David Setter, I wanted to ask you to stand by for just a minute. We have Representative Christopher Cox on the line, joining us from Orange County, California. He's been a member of Congress since 1988, chairman of the House Policy Committee, and also author of a resolution to sanction Russia unless it follows a path to democracy. Welcome, Congressman.
I'm happy to join you and enjoy the discussion.
Well, let me ask you what you want to see Russia do specifically. What would be the actions that would tell you they are on the right path?
I think that David's outlined most of the salient points that concern us in the West. Human rights and democracy are at the forefront. Obviously, in Chechnya, we have a stake because of our concern about extremists using Islam as the pretext for blowing things up, and we don't want Chechnya to become a ground for this. That's not what the war in Chechnya, particularly the second Chechen war that Putin restarted, has been about. It's been about reassembling the Soviet Empire, something that is a foreign policy aim of many of the old KGB hands that today comprise the Russian government. And so we need a Russia that, first of all, is willing to live within its borders, be friendly to its neighbors, not a destabilizing force in that part of the world. Second, a Russia that doesn't assist Iran in its nuclear ambitions and thereby threaten the United States and the rest of the civilized world. Third, a Russia that does not get in the way when we're trying to solve the problems in North Korea. And just as importantly, inside Russia, a leader and a government that respect democratic norms that were set in motion under Boris Yeltsin at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Empire. You know, there needs to be a free press, which flourished under Boris Yeltsin. I think by any standard, Russia is not as democratic today as it was under Yeltsin. Now, economically, in part because of the rise of oil prices, but also in part because of some sound reforms and management that Putin put in place, Russia is far better off today than it was in the 1990s. But the legacy that he's going to leave to his successor, to the next president of Russia, if it is not one who is anointed and appointed by Putin himself, is one of authoritarianism, and that is an instability that bodes ill both for Russia and for the rest of the world.
Congressman, as you know, a couple of your colleagues in the Senate, John McCain and Joe Lieberman, believe that booting the Russians out of the G8 is a way to get their attention on some of these points. Do you agree, and do you think there is much support for that notion on Capitol Hill?
Well, indeed, House Concurrent Resolution 336, which I authored in the 108th Congress, the last Congress, is identical to what Senators Lieberman and McCain have reintroduced in this Congress. And Tom Lantos, Democratic congressman from San Francisco, and I will reintroduce that in the House very shortly. It is my strong view that the G8 should be the G7 unless and until Russia shows itself to be a major democratic industrialized nation, which is the premise of membership in that organization. The observer status that Russia was given when it was the G7 was meant as an encouragement, a carrot, and even a reward for Boris Yeltsin's swift moves towards democracy. But as I said, by any objective measure, Russia today is less democratic now than it was then.
Congressman, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be with you.
Representative Christopher Cox joined us from Orange County, California, chairman of the House Policy Committee. Marshall Goldman, what do you think of that? Are carrots more effective than sticks, or do sticks sometimes get the job done a little faster?
Well, I tell you, I had a little trouble with both what David said and what Congressman Cox said. I'm not sure. I would be the first to say that Russia is not as democratic as it was under the Yeltsin years, although what President Putin says is he has a different definition of democracy, and so by his standards it's there, but by ours it's not. Let me take a issue with some of the things, then I try to answer where we come from. When David Satter said that there had been no democratic elections ever in Russia, I think that's going too far. First of all, when Yeltsin was elected the first time around, he was. Second time around, they controlled the press, so it wasn't quite as free as it was. But, you know, you don't want to give the impression that it was like a Chicago election or something like that, or a Florida election if you really want to. So we've got to be careful about these things. But I would agree with them that the rule of law has always been a problematic issue. I call it the rule of laws. It depends on who's in charge and which laws they want to pick up. But he's right when they say that they've been using arbitrary judgments to go out after certain businessmen. I would add also to some scientists. It's not only the business community that has been involved. Some scientists have been accused of espionage. But what is bothersome about the Yukos case is that I don't want to give the impression that Khodorkovsky or Yukos were just doing everything that everybody else was doing. I mean, there are some accusations of murder, of attempted murder. I've been threatened with libel suit by some of these people. I know people who were threatened with being beaten up. Others were doing it too, but not everybody. So I don't want to excuse them this way. But pushing them out of the G8 is pretty strong medicine. I would never say we would never do that, but I think it's important to let President Bush try to pursue this on a basis to see if it can't be rescued, because once we push them out, we lose that ability to interact with them.
Let's go to our phone lines now. We have a lot of listeners who want to get in on the conversation. First to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Phil, thanks for joining us. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I guess the thing that I'm thinking is the whole reason Russia even tried democracy to begin with is because we basically bankrupted them in the 80s with our defense spending. And I guess now that they have oil, they're going to start rebuilding themselves. And I think in the not too distant future, we can see Russia beginning to start to become more of a superpower again, just as, you know, our purchase of products in China are beginning to causing that sleeping giant to begin to rise. And, you know, that's what I see happening.
Phil, thanks for the call. David Satter, what would be your response to Phil?
I don't think that Russia is going to become a superpower. I think that Russia has such grave internal problems that the real danger is that Russia will enter into a systemic crisis as a result of the failure of the non-energy producing part of the economy on the one hand, and the really stratospheric death rate in Russia, which in recent years has resembled that of a country at war. I think that we need to be very solicitous toward Russia for the simple reason that it is the world's second nuclear power. It is in many ways an extremely powerful military country, which at the same time faces processes that are very dangerous of social disintegration. And that's how I would frame the problem.
I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point. Well, David, let me ask you about this G8 idea. Do you think that's the way to go, or is that too harsh?
Well, it's strange. I mean, I sympathize with the idea of expelling Russia from the G8 for the simple reason that I think that people that they shouldn't have been admitted in the first place. But despite my sympathy for the move to expel them, my feel for the psychology of the country makes me think that should not be our first priority. The first priority should be to speak openly, publicly, and honestly to Russia about the lack of democracy in the country, the atrocities that have been and are being committed in Chechnya, and the self-defeating and self-destructive nature of a lot of the policies of the present Russian political elite. I think that speaking openly, removing the self-censor, if you do all those things, then the question of removing Russia from the G8 becomes secondary, and in fact it may even be advisable to have them in there, because they'll be better placed to listen to what they're being told. At the same time, that kind of influence can have a real effect on the internal situation in Russia and can give moral support for those forces in Russia who really do want the country to be democratic and to start to deal with its very, very serious internal problems.
It's also worth noting that Russia is supposed to host the G8 meeting in 2006, so we'll see how that all plays out.
All the more reason to speak frankly to Russia now. And to make it clear to them that in G8, not in G8, the fact is that if you want to be part of the civilized world, you have to behave in a civilized fashion. There was a 19th century French explorer and writer, the Marquis de Custine, who visited Russia and recounted a conversation with Russian officials in which they said that we would love not to be so despotic, but with our Asiatic people, there's nothing else we can do. And Custine translated this statement into saying, we would love to get rid of even a pretense of democracy in this country, but insofar as we have to deal with civilized European countries, there's not much, we can't afford to do that. And I think that situation exists today.
Well, and Marshall Goldman, also, doesn't this play into the sort of traditional Russian feeling of being put upon by the rest of the world? You know, they're all against us. It's just us.
Oh, very much so. There is this, there is indeed this sense of, you know, paranoia But I mean, just add what David said here. Putin was alleged to have said just recently that Russians are used to a strong Tsar, and we need a strong leader, and that's what I'm trying to do. But because we have to stand up against those who are attacking us, I think it's important, and I would agree with most of what David said here, to keep them in the G8. But I don't think it's realistic to say, well, we're going to keep. Try to address them, point out these problems. The reason being, how do we get through if indeed Putin now controls the media, the main television networks, anyway, the national networks? That's going to be hard to do. And by the way, one of the things that I've discovered with Putin, he points out our shortcomings, and that the trouble is, do we listen? So what makes us think that they're going to listen any better than we do?
We're going to continue in just a moment. David Satter, I understand you have to get back to teaching your class. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
David Satter is a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Foreign Policy Institute and a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. We'll continue in a moment. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. And on the day that the U.S. and Russian presidents met in Europe, we're talking this hour about the points of agreement and pressure for these two sometimes friends. Do you think that publicly increasing the pressure on Russia to make democratic reforms is useful or counterproductive? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And that's 1-800-423-TALK. Marshall Goldman is in the studio with me, Professor Emeritus of Russian Economics at Wellesley College. And joining me from Washington now is Paul Starobin, contributing editor to the Atlantic Monthly magazine and also the author of a new article about President Putin titled The Accidental Autocrat. Paul, welcome.
Thanks.
Great title and a very interesting article. Can you make the case for why Putin might, in fact, be exactly the right man for the times in Russia?
I think I could have made that case a little bit better maybe 2 or 3 years ago than I would make it today. But basically the case is that the Yeltsin years, although they had the trappings of a democracy, were in fact more about a kind of grab for wealth and power and anarchy. That was essentially uncontrolled by a feckless state. So Putin coming in as the kind of man of law and order, the guy from the security organs, the Czechist, is there to sort of fill that social and political vacuum. And so he seemed to the first couple of years. I think now things are getting away from him a bit, so I think Russian politics could be going back to a somewhat unpredictable phase, and it may not be that Putin, after all, is the answer.
Well, how much do you see Putin's crackdown on dissent as perhaps an understandable, if not a logical, follow-up to the terrorist incident at the middle school last September?
Well, I think the crackdown began before that and was in the works. The regional governor's plan to basically appoint them by the Kremlin rather than have them popularly elected was something that I think was in his desk drawer before Beslan, and then he used that episode as a way to kind of make it happen quickly. So I don't think that Beslan really requires a crackdown on dissent. I think the problem is that Putin and his entourage are basically control-oriented people who overplay their hand.
Well, what about the argument that some Russians think perhaps Putin is not tough enough, authoritarian enough?
Yeah, lots of Russians feel that way. I was in Moscow for 4 years as the bureau chief for Business Week, starting in late 99 through August of 2003. The argument on the street that I heard generally about Putin, except from the liberal intelligentsia, was, thank God we've got a tough guy in the Kremlin. Thank God we've got somebody who's going to take a hard knock to these oligarchs, whom Russians generally think of as gangsters. About time. But the problem is that Putin, although he has taken some hard knocks at the likes of Khodorkovsky of Yukos, has really not reined in a lot of the corruption that we see in the business circles in Moscow and outside of Moscow. I mean, that kind of corruption, I think, is still pretty much rampant. So I think, and there are questions about whether Putin's team is starting to stick its own nose into the trough. So, you know, if that's the case, I think the ordinary guy in the street is going to become disillusioned. He might still want a sort of law and order guy, a kind of a nationalist, not a liberal, but it might be somebody other than Putin. It might be somebody even more illiberal.
Hmm. To our phone lines again, to Waterford, Pennsylvania, Dolores is on the line. Hi, Dolores. Welcome.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I have a couple comments. First of all, I'd like to know who the United States is to condemn the Russians for any human rights violations. I mean, historically, the U.S. has supported the brutal dictators in Central America and South America. Look at the relationship with Saddam Hussein in the 80s. And now I believe the U.S. is cozying up to Mr. Niyazov in Turkmenistan, who has been identified as one of the worst dictators. A comment about Yeltsin, he was a drunken buffoon. And I don't think he really had control of Russia at the time. Before, I believe, this administration embarks on an agenda of criticizing the Russians for their failure to embrace democratic ideals, it needs to clean up its own backyard first. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dolores. Marshall?
Wow, that's pretty powerful stuff. Certainly we've had our human rights problems, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't speak out. And just as I think Putin is justified for pointing out some of our failings, and as Dolores did, we do face up to them. I think what is important here is that if we see something going on in Russia, that doesn't mean that we have to be perfectly pure, because that's sometimes disputed within the country. But by all means, we should speak out. She mentioned Turkmenistan. She could have mentioned Uzbekistan, where the rumor is that Karimov, who's the president there, had some people boiled in water who were disagreeing with him. And here's the dilemma. We wanted our bases in Uzbekistan because we were involved in fighting in Afghanistan. And so how do we do that at the same time with a president who is not a sweet man and who's not a nice man? So we have to make compromises here. As far as Yeltsin being a drunken buffoon, he certainly was a drunk and he was an alcoholic. At the same time, you have to give him enormous credit. He stood up during the coup attempt in August 1991, and whatever his drinking habits were, he exposed himself. He stood up for democracy, and I think he had a better appreciation of what democracy was philosophically, as well as his action, than Putin did. I mean, I would agree with Paul that Putin came along and brought a certain amount of order in the wake of Yeltsin's lack of concern or lack of focus, where things really were out of control. But I think it's unfair historically to write Yeltsin off that way, and that he deserves better than that.
To our phone lines again, to Boston, Massachusetts. Deborah's on the line. Hi, Deborah. Welcome.
Hi. I just had a couple of comments. First, I think that Yeltsin and Bush got together and decided that they would both be politically better off if they were partners.
You mean Putin and Bush, or you said Yeltsin and Bush?
I meant Putin. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Putin and Bush got together in Texas, and I think they both decided that politically they would strengthen each other if they were partners. And I think, in fact, that may be so, that we are much better off having Russia as our partner, and I think vice versa. And I don't think it makes too much difference to Putin, the punches that Bush is throwing. I think he really doesn't care at all about it. And I think the same thing is true with Bush. I think that Bush actually was using Putin as a rallying a way to rally the European nations on his side, and saying, well, you know, as democratic nations, we need to let Putin and the people in Russia know just, you know, how, you know, what democracy really is. It put Bush on the side of the European nations.
Deborah. I think we've got it. We're a little short on time, so let me ask Marshall to respond to those points.
Well, I think that there is something to be said for the fact that the two men decided we could have more together in common and we should get together than that. But I do think that Putin does take criticism badly. I mentioned to you earlier that I was in a meeting with him in September with a small group, and when we brought up the question of Chechnya or anything that was critical, he was very quick to respond, defend himself, and sometimes angrily. Whenever we try to make a criticism, he would come right back with a criticism of the United States. But I do think that President Bush, in this particular case, did make his points in the hope of being appealing more to the Europeans to heal some of the wounds that have been existed since the war in Iraq.
Paul Starobin, you make a point in the article. You raise the question as to what Putin might do when his second term is up in March of 2008. According to the Russian Constitution, that's all he gets. Do you think he might make an effort toward a third term?
Well, I mean, everything in Russian politics in Moscow is boxes inside of boxes. I think that there are some options available to Putin. The crudest would be a kind of constitutional change that would give him a third term. I think, you know, there's also the option of somehow finessing things and making Russia into a parliamentary system and allowing Putin to become prime minister. There's talk that there might be some sort of a supra union with, say, Belarus that would give Putin a role. I think it's very much in flux. It's just that it's an interesting, you know, political question that people in Moscow do not assume that this is necessarily the last of Vladimir Putin. But we've got a long way to go. I think, you know, Russian politics are becoming, as I said, unpredictable. Again, just as today, there was an interesting report that the prime minister that Putin basically fired, Mikhail Kasyanov, who's associated with the Yeltsin regime, is hinting at a presidential run in 2008. And just the fact that he is hinting at that, I think, is a suggestion that there's a perception of weakness in the Putin regime right now. And these things can pick up some momentum, so we'll just have to watch that.
Paul, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Paul Starobin is contributing editor to The Atlantic Monthly, wrote an article in this month's issue called The Accidental Autocrat. He was the Moscow bureau chief for Business Week from 1999 to 2003. And our thanks to Marshall Goldman.
Thank you, Gail. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, we appreciate your being with us, as always. Professor Emeritus of Russian Economics at Wellesley College, also Associate Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University, and author of The Piratization of the Russian Economy. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. This is On Point. For decades, the Alaskan permafrost has been offering up frozen specimens to any scientist willing to do the digging. Many of the finds are in near-perfect form, preserved in the frozen ground like meat in a freezer. But normally, the specimens are dead. Well, not so for a newly discovered microorganism that may have interstellar implications. NASA scientist Richard Hoover announced on Wednesday that a microbial life form frozen at least 30,000 years ago began swimming the moment it thawed. News of the miraculous reanimation was followed by the announcement from the European Space Agency that a probe had photographed what is believed to be a frozen sea near the equator of Mars. Taken together, the two stories have reinvigorated hopes of finding life on the red planet one day. And joining me now from Huntsville, Alabama, is NASA scientist Richard Hoover. Richard, welcome to you.
Yes, good evening, Gail. I'm delighted to be with you today.
So put us in your shoes. What went through your mind when there you are looking at this life form, 30,000 years old, and it starts to swim?
Well, it was tremendously exciting, I must say. I had been collecting samples in the Fox permafrost tunnel just outside of Fairbanks, Alaska, and taking samples out of a frozen pond that had been frozen for 32,000 years. And as soon as I got the samples back to the University of Alaska and put a small bit of the brownish colored ice on a microscope slide, and the ice melted. Right after the ice had melted, there were literally thousands and thousands of these tiny bacteria in the drop of water that immediately began swimming as the ice thawed.
I can just imagine the double take you must have done.
Well, it was tremendously exciting because I knew that they were very, very intriguing microorganisms. But, of course, at that point in time, I didn't know that they would represent a new species of bacteria. That took literally several years of research in order to do the detailed DNA analysis to prove that these organisms were different from all other validly published species of bacteria.
I want to know how you were able to figure out that these things were 30,000 years old.
Well, actually, that measurement was done by other scientists who had studied the Fox Tunnel. This is a tunnel in Alaska that was drilled in the 1960s when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was exploring techniques of how they would make machinery for drilling in the permafrost for the building of the Alaska pipeline. And after they had cored this area out of a hillside in Fairbanks, Alaska, they then built large doors and refrigeration equipment so that the tunnel that they had made always stayed at minus 4 degrees C or lower, so it would never melt. And the scientists then came and studied the permafrost, and they did radiocarbon analysis of sections of wood and moss and sedges that were at various levels in the permafrost of the tunnel, and it was based on their measurements that we knew the age of this particular level of Pleistocene ice.
Well, I don't want to sound too sci-fi here, but is it possible that some harmful microbes or even viruses from the past could thaw out and be dangerous to us as humans?
Well, yes, quite frankly, it is possible in certain areas. I mean, if you went and you dug up areas where people had been frozen after having, like, the 1918 flu, the viruses that they contain within their bodies could definitely be harmful. One of the things that most people don't realize is that the vast majority of the microorganisms, of the bacteria, in the soil on the planet Earth are totally and completely harmless to man. In fact, a large number of bacteria are very helpful, and there are some that are absolutely essential that we would not be able to survive without. There are only about 200 species of bacteria on the planet Earth that are really nasty bugs that do horrible things to human beings. And of the other 6,000 validly published forms and who knows how many bacteria that have never been described in the scientific literature, the vast, vast majority of those organisms live their lives perfectly happily and never do anything harmful to human beings whatsoever.
Well, in just the few seconds we have left, does this increase the chances of finding life on another planet?
Well, what it does is it says we now have a much better idea of where is a wonderful place to search for life on Mars. And that wonderful place is this fabulous discovery of the frozen sea on Mars in Elysium Planitia that was discovered by the European Space Agency's Mars Express spacecraft. Very near the equator, the sun shines on the upper layer of dust, and of course that gets warm. And so these layers between the dust and rocks and the ice could be melting quite frequently, and that is an ideal place where microorganisms could be living today on Mars.
Dr. Hoover, thanks so much. We appreciate your being with us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Richard Hoover is a scientist at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. He spoke with us from Huntsville, Alabama. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.